Well, several years ago, here in Atlanta at our collection of churches, we did a series called My Bad Church Experience. And if you're in any of our rooms, if you were here for that series, will you just raise your hand up really, really high? That's awesome. Those are the long timers at our church. I think it was over 12 years ago. I didn't say old timers, by the way. I said long timers. They've been around for a while, and it's amazing that they're still here because the series was so long that it in and of itself became people's bad church experience. But one of the things I got to share in that story, in that series, was a story that is really relevant to what we're going to talk about today. I was in seminary, which is graduate school for becoming a professional Christian, which is what pastors do. They go to grad school, and while I was in grad school, one of the things we had to do was go visit churches. And the goal was to go visit churches, different styles of churches, and experience them and then sort of evaluate your experience. You know, what did you like? What didn't you like? You know, did they accomplish what they were trying to accomplish? So there were lots of different criteria. And so I went to this smaller church. I wanted to go experience something a little more intimate. I went to this smaller church and later found out it was small for a reason, but it was a smaller church. And I got there and it was one of those churches where if you don't know when to sit or stand or kneel or whatever, like you're totally lost. And so I was sort of like fumbled through the experience, but I thought, you know, there was meaning in a lot of the things that we were doing, they were talking about, so we were going through this whole thing, and then the sermon came, and then we're near the end of the service, and honestly, my experience there, it kind of opened my eyes. It was mostly fine. I was like, you know, this is a different way to experience church, different way to do church, and these people seem to like it. Well, at the end of the service, the pastor stands up. He says, hey, we're almost done for today. We have one more item on our thing that we have to do today. And he asks a guy in about the fifth row to stand up. And he says, hey, today we need to settle a matter. We need to do some church discipline. And I immediately started to sweat. I was like, oh gosh, like this is going to happen like right now. Like, and again, it's not a big room, but it's big enough that this is really awkward. And I'm sitting near the back and I'm like trying to figure out like, can I get out of here? Like, what is going on? And he says the guy's name and he proceeds to tell everyone that he's been caught in marriage infidelity and his wife sitting next to him. Pew sobbing, and like it's like this super awkward, super straight. And he talks about church discipline and why this is important and why you bring people in front of the church and like his interpretation of that whole idea. And I honestly, I thought I couldn't get out of there fast enough. I left and I thought, if that's what I gotta do in church, I'm out. Like, I'm not doing this. Like, that is not something I want to do. I mean, it not only didn't seem helpful for them, like this was going to be something that the church was there to help them. It just didn't seem kind. It didn't seem Christ-like. It didn't seem what this guy needed in the moment. And we're in the middle of a series called What Our World Needs Now. And we're talking about what people in our world need. And one of the things we've said is that people need Christians who are more Christ-like. They need followers of Jesus who act in ways and react in ways that are more Christ-like and they look more like Christ. And strangely, it's as we've been talking in this series, it's not a list of things to do. We're not walking away going, hey, here's a list of things to do and here's how you do them. We're unpacking these ideas the way they're presented in the scriptures, and they're presented as the fruit of the Spirit. These are certain things that they're outcomes in our lives, and they come through submission to God's Spirit within us. And they're produced in and through our lives. And so far, we've looked at several of them. The fruit of the Spirit we've seen is love. And it was sort of a catch-all. Andy kicked our series off with that idea. And joy and peace and patience. Next up on the list is kindness. And so I want to talk just about the nature of kindness a little bit first. But here's one of the things that I want to acknowledge is, you know, most of these things people wouldn't argue with. Like, our world needs more love and joy and peace and patience. And most of you would go, and our world needs more kindness too, but do you know that's not everybody thinks so? In fact, there are Christians who don't think so. And it's subtle. They wouldn't say it out loud like, hey, we shouldn't be more kind. But there are Christians who think, you know, kindness isn't something that we should linger into, you know, too easily. And some of you are the Disney fans are thinking, wait, no, everybody knows that we should be kind. I mean, Cinderella taught us this, have courage and be kind. And we memorize it. It's like, this is how you should live. But some people think when it comes to kindness, when it can be dangerous, that too much kindness or the wrong kind of kindness in certain circumstances can be dangerous, because kindness is often displayed through tolerance. And people misinterpret and in some cases they receive our kindness as tolerance and that tolerance as consent. And there's all sorts of people who are going, yeah, I know that that seems kind, but that seems like you're letting people get away with it. And we would all say that there's certain types of behaviors that are not good that we shouldn't give consent to. There's toxic behaviors. There's unhealthy and harmful behaviors and ideologies that hurt people. But so often we throw kindness out. It's like, oh yeah, I know that's the kind thing to do, but that's not what you should do in this situation because that'll be seen as tolerance and that'll be seen as consent. But I think what we do is we actually misinterpret or we confuse kindness with niceness. You know, these aren't the same things. Kindness is a other-centered behavior. It's not something about me. It's I'm acting in the best interest of others with a sense of love and empathy and compassion. Niceness is something different. Niceness is that sort of thing that we're all familiar with in the South. If you're from another part of the world, you don't live in the South, this is true. And we know this about ourselves. It's like oftentimes you say what you need to say to be nice, to put on a happy face with people, to try to please other people, to avoid causing waves, to ensure that people like you. Because we want to be likable and we want to be hospitable. And we confuse oftentimes this kindness and this niceness. But as we're going to see today, nice isn't necessarily kind. And kindness doesn't always present itself as nice. Nice isn't necessarily kind. And kindness doesn't always present itself as nice. So I want to talk about this word kind for a second. Do a little etymology. I know this is going to be a little bit geeky for some of you, but we're going to go there anyway. So the Greek word that in Galatians chapter 5 for the Greek word for kindness, the root of it is this word Christos. It sounds like Christ. It's a completely different word, but Christos, and it means fit for use or useful. So think about this. Kindness is something that should be helpful and useful and fit to who we are and what we ought to be. And the reason we know that is because when it was translated into English, we use this Old English word. And this is the Old English word right here. And this Old English word that's the root of the word kind in our English language is the word that comes from kin or class or family. It's the word that goes with humankind. In fact, in Genesis chapter 1, this is the same idea. Humankind. It was created, and it was created in the image of God. Now, here's why I bring this up front, because when you combine these two things and you get a fuller understanding of what this idea, that this fruit of the Spirit is kindness, here's what we get. The implication is that kindness points to a character quality. It's not only useful or essential, but it reflects the central attribute of what it means to be truly human. This is who we were actually meant to be. This is in the list of things that we're given, this is one of those that's so closely related with what it is to be human, but was lost in the fall. It was tainted in the fall. And the presence of sin and brokenness in our world, it separated us from what it looks like to truly be human and to be kind. So the question is, and this is what I want to pack. And yes, I brought my board today. And Andy says it's my magic board. But here's the thing, regardless of what he says, there's no magic in the board. I actually have to draw everything that's up here. It doesn't actually appear. So we're going to talk about today, and I want to unpack and I want to try to diagram what it means to be kind. Not just my opinion or my version of kindness. What I want to look at is, I want to look at what this human kindness looks like. According to the model of Jesus, what it looks like, what it acts like, and what it reacts like. And in such a way that we can evaluate the way in which we live and how kind or unkind we are to other people around us. Now, Jesus came, when he said, one of the things, when he talked about his purpose, when he talked about what he came to do, one of Jesus' stated purpose was to restore humanity so that we might have life to the full. He wanted you to experience a fullness of life. He wanted to restore you mind, body, and soul into a way that represented what you were meant to experience. Ultimately, you know, on the other side of this life, to fully do that. But even to begin that transformational process now, he came that you would experience this fullness of life. And in the process, he modeled what true human kindness looks like. And I want to look at a story in John chapter 8 today that represents one of the best examples of Jesus's kindness towards someone. If you don't have a Bible, I'm going to put the words on the screen, but if you have a Bible, I'd love for you to open it. Or if you got a device and you want to follow along with us, I'd love for you to do that. I say this all the time, but if you don't have a Bible, whether you're here at this location or any of our locations, if you don't have a Bible, I want you to have one. And somebody there will either give you one or reach out to me. I'll buy you one. I want you to have a physical Bible because there's so much. Hopefully you'll when we see this story today, you'll go, I need to read more of what's in that book because it's so helpful, not just inspiring. It's so helpful. So the story we're going to look at today begins with a bunch of people coming to Jerusalem for what was known as the Festival of Tabernacles. The Festival of Tabernacles. And so they're all coming. It's one of the major Jewish festivals. All these people are coming from the surrounding regions, and they come, and when they get there, Jesus shows up with his disciples, and he goes to the temple. And when he gets to the temple, he starts teaching in the temple. Now, he's not one of the sanctioned rabbis, the teachers, the religious leaders in the temple. He just stands up and starts teaching. And when he starts teaching, the people are amazed at his teaching, is what we're told in chapter 7. People are amazed by his teaching. And at one point, Jesus then even declares and associates himself with being the Messiah. And so this would have caused huge waves. The religious leaders, the Pharisees, the teachers of the law, they all were up in arms over this. This was like, if he is the Messiah, it's extraordinary. If he's not the Messiah, it's heresy. But they're in a position where Jesus, if this is true of him, they don't want it to be true of him, if it's true of him, he suddenly is the one in power. He outranks them. And so they all get whipped up in a tizzy, and they call the temple guard. And they get the temple guard to come, and they say, you need to arrest Jesus because he's being a heretic. And for a number of reasons, the temple guard don't see a reason to arrest him. So they leave, and then Jesus leaves. And that's sort of the end of the evening, end of the day. He goes out sort of up to a mountain, the Mount of Olives, stays the night. And then at dawn, we're told, at dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. So here's the picture. All these people gather around him, and usually when people would gather around him, the rabbi would stand above them and teach the people who've gathered around him, one, so he can be seen, but because he's standing up as the authority, as the teacher. And this is important. You're going to see in a minute that there's no mistakes when it comes to the Greek language. It's very, between the repetition and the imagery, Jesus intentionally sits down to teach them. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They found this woman caught in adultery, and they bring her in, and they made her stand before the group. So here's the group. Jesus is sitting down teaching them. They bring this woman in. She's made to stand in front of this whole group, and they said to Jesus, not to the group, they said to Jesus, teacher, you've decided to stand up. You're supposedly an authority in the temple. By the way, we don't know why you're sitting down, but teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery in the law. See, there's no confusion. She was caught in the act. In the law, Moses commands us to stone such a woman. Now, what do you say? That she was caught in the act. There's no question as whether she's done this or not. She's caught in the act. The law of Moses says we should stone her. What do you say? You've been preaching about God's love, but there's something else going on here. And there's a lot going on here, and I don't want to get sideways energy, but my first question when I read this is, where's the dude? Right? If you're caught in the act, they caught the dude too, right? And the same law applies to him as applies to her. But he's not there for some reason. I don't know, unless he's one of them. I don't know. But she's brought in front of them. I'm thinking, this is messed up already. There's already something wrong with the situation. And the reality is that this woman was being used as a pawn to charge Jesus with heresy. They're not bringing it for justice sake or for her sake or for the community's sake. This is about them trying to get at Jesus. And we know that because John tells us. John says they were using this question as a trap in order to have him, to have a basis for accusing Jesus. This was actually quite clever because they're attempting to expose. They're clever. Jesus is brilliant. We'll see that in a second. They're clever, and Jesus, they're attempting to expose Jesus for an apparent contradiction. You're over here preaching about God's love, and you're seemingly disregarding God's law given to us through Moses. And so here's the situation. You're preaching all about God's love. What about God's law? We're going to put you right on the spot. But the truth is that they do it in a way that's the exact opposite of what it is to be kind. And this is what sets us up to really understand the kindness of Jesus. They're not just nasty, they're cruel. This is downright cruel. They're not doing this for anybody's benefit other than their own. This is selfishness. This is, I'm in this for me, and we're coming to confront you, Jesus. You're preaching about God's love. Here's God's law. This woman's broken God's law. What should we do? The law says to stone her. What do you say? Jesus responds, and I love this. Jesus, we're told by John, bent down, and he started writing on the ground with his finger. Just like, what is that? Everybody, again, here's the scene. Everybody's here. Jesus bends down. He probably stood up when they came in, and he bends down. And everybody's like, what are you doing? So here's what's interesting. Again, the contrast between kind and cruel. I'm going to contrast two other things that show up in the story. Jesus bent down. This is a unique Greek word. It's the Greek word koupto. You're going to be way smarter when you leave here today. The Greek word is koupto. And it means to stoop down or to bend down or to lower yourself. And the reason this would have been strange is because this would have been unthinkable if Jesus stood up when this woman was brought in front of him. For him to bend down as a teacher, as I told you earlier, would have been abnormal in the temple. But now he's bending down, he's stooping down, he's lowering himself in front of a woman. That would have never happened by somebody in authority. Most men, it wouldn't have happened, particularly by somebody in authority. And the question is, what is he writing, right? It's like, wouldn't you love to be there? And it's like, okay, none of us can read Greek or Aramaic. I'm not sure what he was writing in, but he's writing on the ground and none of us can read this. So you go, like, what's the purpose of the writing? Well, most scholars believe that this is Jesus doubling down on his Messiah claim. And the reason most scholars think that is because the Pharisees would have known the law forwards and backwards. They would have known the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. Most of them would have had this memorized. And in Exodus chapter 31, we're told that God wrote the law with his finger on the tablets. God wrote the law, gave the law. He inscribed the law on the tablets with his finger. This is Jesus that most people believe. Jesus stooping down and he's beginning to write. He's cueing in the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. I am God's final king. The king is the lawgiver. He's the lawmaker. And I'm identifying myself, associating myself with God who gave this law. You think you're testing me on what this law means, but I'm where this law originated. And when they kept on questioning him, he straightened up. Another key idea. He straightened up. This is what's awesome. This is what I love about the straighten. Sometimes it's hard to talk and write at the same time when you're writing different words than you're saying. This word is the opposite of the other word. As a matter of fact, it has the other word in it. This is the word anakoupto. So koupto and anakoupto. He bent down, he straightened up. He bent down, he lowered himself. Now he's gonna raise himself up. He's gonna stand up, and he's gonna stand up both literally and figuratively. He stands up, he straightened up, and he said to them, he said, here's the deal. Let any one of you who is without sin be the first one to throw a stone at her. If any of you are without sin, you should begin the stoning. To which most of us go, huh, that's a clever comeback. But here's the wild thing is, it's because we don't have a picture for stoning. We don't even know what that means. Like, is this like they took skip rocks and they started pelting somebody, or is these baseball size rocks? No, these were like massive rocks. These are like these size rocks. And here's the thing, you can read this. If you were to read the Talmud, which is like the rabbinic teachings in the first and second century, you read these teachings. It details what they had done. This is not the way it was laid out in Deuteronomy when stoning was commanded for heresy. But what it had divulged into was when a person was gonna be stoned, their hands were tied behind their back. They were shoved off a ledge, usually into a hole that was dug. That was two times their height. They were shoved into this, off this ledge or into a hole. And then people began to throw rocks. In fact, oftentimes, usually the first rock was so big it had to be carried by two people. And they would throw rocks down into this pit. And it was so terrible. And if the first rock didn't kill them, they proceeded and everyone else would begin to throw stones. And so Jesus says, look, all right, go get your stones. Whoever here, if you don't have any sin, you go ahead and throw the first stone. If I'm going to be the judge, everybody's playing. And you're either going to be judged or you're going to judge. Those of you without sin, you're going to be throwing stones. Those of you who are with sin, you're going to get judged in this moment too. If this is how you want to play this game with her, that's how we're going to play it. And he stooped down. He stooped down and he wrote on the ground again. I think the idea, Jesus, as he's sort of playing this game a little bit, he's playing their game. They started the game. He didn't like to play games, but they started the game. It's the same word here. It says stoop down, but he bent down. It's the second time we see it. I've told you this before. Repetition's important. When you see it, you should pay attention. Jesus stoops down again. And I think he's saying, look, the purpose of my law isn't to punish. The purpose of God's law was to serve and to guard and to protect people. That's why it was given in the very beginning. But if this is the way you want to play, if this is the game you want to play, you choose. Which interpretation of the law should we use? Yours or mine? If it's mine, then you have to put down your rock. If it's yours, everybody's playing. And at this, those who heard began to go away one at a time. The older ones first. I love that. They're the wise ones. The younger guys are like, no, we can take him. And they're like, no, we can't take him. We're out. Like, let's go. We'll live for another day. Like, we got to go. And the older ones left first until only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. And they're leaving. Represented both their admission of guilt and a concession in the debate. So Jesus diffuses the situation. He's the only one standing there that could actually do the stoning. And Jesus instead, he sets down his rock. He diffuses the situation. They all put down their stones. They all leave. And what's interesting about this is they all leave thinking two things. They leave thinking, well, Jesus seems to be okay with adultery, and he doesn't care about the law of Moses. I mean, honestly, he didn't give him a speech beforehand saying, now don't misrepresent my words, don't misrepresent what I did. He just defends her, runs them off, and they leave. And here's what's interesting. He did not seem concerned with how they might misrepresent what was happening. He didn't try to control the narrative. Instead, he straightened up second time. He bent down twice. He straightened up twice. He straightened up and he asked her, woman, where are they? Where'd everybody go? Has no one condemned you? Imagine this. She's like, I mean, you're the only one that's still here. You put down your rock. No one. No one, sir, she said. And then Jesus said this. He said, Then neither do I condemn you. And if we're honest, some of us, this bothers us. It bothers us because it's like, wait a minute, if he's not condemning this, is he condoning it? Like he's just gonna let her off? Like, and this is the divisive trap we fall into all the time. When we're trying to be kind, when we're trying to do what Jesus did, instead of seeing somebody in a situation, we're seeing them for who they are, and we're seeing them in their need, and we're seeing that they need somebody to rescue and help them and lift them up and we succumb to this idea that kindness is somehow tolerance and somehow tolerance is consent. And here's the awesome thing. Little did they know, Jesus wasn't done. He wasn't concerned with what they thought, but he wasn't done either. After acting on her behalf publicly, after publicly stepping in the gap, risking a lot, stepping between her and the Pharisees, after doing all of that in a very personal and private moment, he said to her, go now and leave your life of sin. I believe Jesus walked over to her, and I imagine she was down the ground at this point in tears. She'd be a puddle as he's run off all these people. She thinks she's turned near, a certain death is near, and he's rescued her, and she's probably fallen to the ground, and Jesus bends down and he says, stop it. What you're doing is not good. It's not good for you. And here's what we see. His approach was the antithesis of the religious leaders. And he wasn't just nice to her. Nice would have been defending her, or maybe even nice would have just been like, hey, I don't know. They're the religious leaders. I mean, whatever they say goes. I mean, who knows what niceness looked like, but it wouldn't have been kind. Kindness prioritized her real need. And it was extending beyond comfort. It was extending beyond people's perception. He defended her, and then he spoke truth to her. So the question is, what does kindness look like? Christ-like kindness look like, act like, and react like? These two ideas are two examples of what this looks like. And I think there's a lot going on here, but there's a lot of similarity in what it looks like for us today to be kind. And Jesus bending down was a humble posture. This was the posture of a servant. Somebody of authority in the temple would never do this and wouldn't do it in front of a woman. But he takes on this posture of a servant. And he even said about himself, when he was referring to himself, he said, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. And then just not long after that, he went on to illustrate this in the most amazing of ways when he washed the disciples' feet. But this bending down metaphorically illustrates Jesus choosing to humble himself before this situation, before this woman, choosing to serve her. Kindness says, what can I do to serve you in your need? And then the second thing was this straightening up. This wasn't elevating. But here's the amazing thing is Jesus didn't just raise up, just didn't elevate, just didn't just stand up to them. When he decided to stand up, and this is true. This isn't just a standing up. He stood up and he leveraged his power and his influence for someone in need. And he wasn't just standing up for others. He was lifting somebody else up with him. This is what Jesus was doing. He's elevating, but when he stood up to stand up to the Pharisees, he said, I'm gonna lift this person. I'm gonna lift their dignity up with me. And both of them, these are both extraordinary illustrations of something John tells us at the very beginning. So context is important. We're in John chapter 8. In John chapter 1, this is what John tells us about Jesus. He came from God, and when he came from God, he was full of two things. He was full of grace and he was full of truth. He was full of both of them. It wasn't like a balance of or a little bit of each. He was offering both of these. It was like he didn't compromise on the grace and he didn't compromise on the truth. He was full of both of them. To compromise on either one is not kind. It's not kind. In fact, when it comes to grace and truth, Jesus, he's the fullness of both of these things, which means he's at the intersection of where these overlap. And the intersection of where these overlap is where we find ourselves truly being kind. This is kindness. But this is not how they acted. Because if you're all about truth, you're just all about the truth. When you're all about the truth, you're condemning. You choose to condemn people. I had to make sure I spelled that right. When you're all about the truth, and you've seen this before. This was a story I told you in the beginning. It's like, this is what's right. This is what somebody deserves. I'm just telling you the facts. I don't know about the personal situation. I don't know about all the nuance around it. Like, but this is the deal. And we often find ourselves when we want to be all about the truth, we're condemning. And here's the other side of that is when we're all about grace, we're condoning. If we're just about the truth or just about the grace, the truth is it's still cruel. The Pharisees' behavior is cruel. Jesus' behavior without the truth would have been nice, but it wouldn't have been condoning behavior that wasn't good, not just for the community, not just for somebody else, for her. Instead, Jesus says, I see you, and I've come to serve you, and I want to lift you out of the pit that you find yourself in. I see you. I see what you did. I see where you've been. And I don't condemn you. But what you did matters. It matters because you matter. And it's not good for you. Stop it. I want more for you. I want to lift you out of what you're in the midst of. Years ago, I had my first experience where I was a young leader in doing church work as a young pastor, and I had to be a part of an intervention. And we were going to confront somebody, and his behavior had been damaging to people around him and betraying, and it even had impact on me. And thankfully, there was an older, wiser gentleman that was sort of guiding our time together. And it was a small circle. We brought this small circle together, and he didn't know what was happening, but he showed up. And some of you are going, this sounds like the story you told at the beginning, but I promise you, it was very different. And we showed up, and the guy who was guiding our time began to describe how this was going to go. And he said, here's what I want to do. I want to first start to my left, and I want to go around the circle. And the guy was sitting on his right, and I want you to hear why everyone is here. I want everybody to tell you. And he kind of queued us up for this ahead of time. And to a person, everybody went around and talked about how much they loved this guy and how much they were for him and how much they knew what he was doing was not who he really was. And they cared about him and his family and his future. We went all the way around the circle, and we got to the end, and I was like, this is so great. Let's all hug and go home. Like, this is so nice. And then he said, we're going to go back around. We're going to take a second lap. And now on the second lap, I want you to hear how your behavior and your actions have impacted all of the people in the circle. And we went around the circle, and people shared about what he was doing and how it impacted them personally. How it had hurt them, how it put them at risk. And it was as heartbreaking and difficult as it was so incredibly powerful. After spending a good bit of time, it was emotional, a good bit of time sharing how much we care about this guy. Also, the truth was on the table. And I remember it was so powerful for me personally. I mean, I remember I did not want to do this. I did not want to be a part of it. I just thought, hey, why don't you just handle this? I don't need to be a part of it. He's like, no, you need to be a part of this. One, because you're going to have to do this one day. But two, because this is you're one of the parties involved here. And so I remember walking away. And I remember the days after as he responded. And we got involved, and this was a long-term process of encouraging this guy, caring for him, and seeing him restored and seeing him rescue and save his family. It was extraordinary. And the thing is it was so powerful for me, for what it did for me, not just what it did for him. Do you know this is actually a better way to live for you? That living this sort of way, living this Jesus kindness way with full of grace and truth is actually better for you. And just let me be a nerd for a second. There are countless studies in the field of psychology that verify the fact that true other-centered kindness makes people happier and healthier. Not just improves their mood. It makes them healthier physically. Did you know, don't roll your eyes, there's 4 neurotransmitters that are activated in your body. I know some of you are like, oh, neuroscience again. Just hang with me for just a minute. This is for your benefit. I'm trying to tell you it's not only a better way to live, this is good for you. Do you know there's 4 neurotransmitters that are activated when you act in ways that are truly kind to other people? Serotonin's the first one. This is actually a calming. You get anxiety around things like this, but serotonin has a calming effect. It's a chemical your body produces when you're engaged in true acts of kindness that are calming for you. Dopamine's a second one. Dopamine is your happiness, your pleasure chemical, and it produces dopamine in your body. And then endorphins improve your mood. If you're in a depressive mood, true acts of kindness will actually increase your mood. And then lastly, oxytocin, which it has all sorts of benefits, but the primary thing that it does is it decreases stress. Cortisol is what produces stress in your body. And oxytocin actually regulates. It's more powerful than the cortisol in your body. And so these four things are present, and there's lots of different activities. You've heard of this. You've seen some of these words before. They're produced through lots of different activities. Romantic relationships and exercise. There's all sorts of things that produce this. But did you know that neurobiologists have discovered the highest levels of release of all four of these things in the human experience is when a mother is feeding her newborn baby? Isn't that extraordinary? When a mother is feeding her newborn baby, the highest levels of these chemicals are produced in the body. And it affects both the mother and the baby. And the benefits are unbelievable. Some of you work at a hospital, you work in labor and delivery, you could teach this part of the sermon. For the baby, there's an attunement that happens in their developing brain, and there's bonding that takes place. And it sets them up, it creates a basis for a healthy life going forward. The mother providing for their child, and for the mother, it can provide the highest benefits of all of these things in her body. And it provides a calming for her and what is, she just gone through a crisis. You know, delivery is a crisis. If you've never been there, I've been there 4 times. It's a crisis event, I'm telling you. I mean that in the kindest way, but it's a crisis event. I love my wife. I love you, babe. It's calming. It provides pleasure. There's improved mood. And it provides stress relief. It even supports the mother's recovery. This is the way God designed your body to work. And these chemicals are keys in it. This is the best part. Do you know, according to the most advanced neurobiological research, only true acts of kindness come even close to what a mother experiences when she's providing for her child's greatest need. Only true acts of human kindness that are other-centered, that are you going, hey, I want to be humble. How can I serve? And you're here. I'm here to elevate and to help somebody else. This isn't about me. This isn't how I look. This isn't about how I look. This isn't about, you know, me being elevated. It's about me caring for someone. And you know what's amazing? It affects both the giver and receiver in this way. It elevates these levels in both the person that's acting in kindness and the person who's receiving the kindness. Now, this is so difficult for some of us, and here's why. And this is unfortunate, but the reason that it's so difficult for us is because we have a hard time separating people from what they've done. Like, that's our problem. We have a hard time separating those things, and I understand it. Some of you have been hurt by somebody, or when someone, maybe the person that has hurt you, that you're trying to go, I mean, you want me to be kind to me, and that's crazy. But we can't separate those two things. And like the Pharisees, oftentimes we think, you know, they had it coming. You know, they're caught in their own snare, and they deserve the consequences that they're going to experience. They brought this on themselves. They knew better. We warned them. What'd you think was going to happen? And oftentimes I think that's more about us than it is about them. I think many of us, we like to hold the rock. See, when we're holding the rock, we feel superior. We want to make sure justice is served. But the reality is when we're holding the rock, people's attention is on somebody else. It's not on us. No, we're the ones that are going to set things straight. That's what we're here for. That's why we're holding the rock. Don't point this back at me. I'm not the one that's the offender. I'm not a party to this. Like, we like to hold the rock because it makes us feel elevated. And if that's you, look, I don't know why that is. But you should think about that. I don't know why. Maybe it's because you have an injury in your past. Maybe it's because of somebody's harmed you. But if you find yourself reflexively wanting to see people outed, see people get consequences for their mistakes, like that's something that's going on inside of you. In fact, my counselor would also often say that to me. She would say, you need to pay attention to that. And I'm like, pay attention to what? She's like, you should pay attention. You need to think about that because that's significant. And I'm like, well, why is it significant? She goes, I don't know. You should think about it. I'm like, I'm paying you to think about it. Just tell me. I don't need to think about it. You already know. The truth is, nobody can tell you. You need to discover that for yourself. But here's the thing. If anybody had the right to carry the rock, it was Jesus. And he put the rock down. He chose in the midst of this circumstance to experience, to show extraordinary kindness. And he did it. And it started when he separated her from her sin. He saw her as a person, as a human being, as someone in need. And he reacts not on the basis of what she's done, but on the basis of what her need was. Not on the basis of what others thought about her as an adulterer or believed about her, but on the basis of what she needed. And she didn't need this. That wasn't going to solve anything. And it's not why he came. And the truth is when we can't separate people from their sin, we react. And we act in ways that don't represent who we were meant to be. You were meant to be kind. Your human kindness, if you were to reflect the way God originally designed you, is to be fit for use, to be useful to other people, to serve other people, to elevate other people. The truth is when we can't separate those things, we become something other than what we were meant to be. We act in ways that are not Christ-like. And I'll be honest with you, it's exhausting. This rock is really heavy right now. And some of you have been carrying it a long time. You've been treating people on the basis of their performance, their sins and their faults and their failures. And just like the Pharisees, we become hypocrites because we all fall short in so many different ways. Now, some of you are even still thinking in this moment, but is that responsible? I mean, there's no consequences, no promise or commitment. I mean, he should have at least gotten a commitment from her that she wasn't going to do this anymore. No guarantee that she'd turn away from her sinful ways. Nope. But he did the same thing for you. When he separated you from your sin, and when he separated me from my sin, the truth is the woman is you and the woman is me. And it's his kindness that led us to repentance. Paul said it this way, I'll close with this. Paul said, don't you see how wonderfully kind and tolerant, patient God is with you? Does this mean nothing to you? Has this not so affected you that it affects the way you treat other people? He treated you the way he designed you to be in his image. Humankind was meant to treat other people with patience and kindness. Does this mean nothing to you? Can't you see that kindness is intended to turn you from your sin? I don't know why we think this is going to cause people to turn from their sin. It doesn't work that way. Jesus said, go follow my way. Remember, this is a fruit that has to be borne out. And the truth is we do this by choosing to humble ourselves, focused on serving other people and choosing to elevate people who've gone the wrong way, because that's what Jesus did for us. So many of us can't do that because we're holding the rock. It keeps us from humbling ourselves. It keeps us from being truly Christ-like. So what does Christ-like kindness look like, act like, and react like? Well, for starters, it begins choosing to put down the rock and choosing to serve, not to be served. Choosing to elevate instead of put down. That is the way of true human kindness, Christ-like kindness. Let me pray for you. God, I pray that we would be a community that would be like that. That we would represent you well in this world. Rescue us from the things that we need to grow through. Rescue us from being people that are so concerned with what other people think about us that we're just going to be nice and we're just going to let things go and we're just going to step out of the way or we're not going to speak up. We're just going to be all about grace. And rescue us from being always having to be right. Make sure people are get what's coming them. I pray that you would help us to realize that nobody gets away with anything. You judge everything. You're the judge and you're the jury. You sent us out. You asked us to follow in the way of Jesus in a way that would humble us and elevate others. That's true human kindness. I pray that we would be people that would represent that to those around us and to the world around us, because that's what our world needs now. I pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.